एक मिनट रुक जाओ, रेडी होने दो। चलो ये कर लेते हैं, दिस कुड बी अ ग्रेट इंट्रो।
हाय, आई एम अक्षय।
हाय, दिस इज सौरभ एंड यू आर लिसनिंग टू द फाउंडर थीसिस पॉडकास्ट। वी मीट सम ऑफ द मोस्ट सेलिब्रेटेड स्टार्टअप फाउंडर्स इन द कंट्री
एंड वी वांट टू लर्न हाउ टू बिल्ड अ यूनिकॉर्न।
इन द ट्रेडिशनल मेल डोमिनेटेड सोसाइटी ऑफ इंडिया, अ वुमन्स प्लेस इज इन द किचन। But a new breed of female entrepreneurs are shattering the glass ceiling and breaking the mold by blazing their own trail, be it in the kitchen or in the corporate world. And Rashmi Daga is one such superwoman. She has always made the most unconventional career choices a woman can make, from doing engineering in a male-dominated field to joining a career in sales to eventually quitting the corporate world to start up her food tech venture, Fresh Menu. Join Akshay Dutt in this fascinating conversation with Rashmi Daga, founder of Fresh Menu, who talks about her mission to build an iconic Indian food brand and organization.
Did you like have a like a plan that, okay, I want to do a job for a couple of years and then start my own, or was it like organic?
No, I think a few years of job was important because I think we just finished education and you have no real life, real world experience. And I think it was important to just go out there, work and really learn the ropes of doing a business. I think after the first, so I had worked for 7 years before I bootstrapped a startup and started again. So yeah, I think it needed a few years of experience. Looking behind, I think it was more organic. But yeah, I think it was sure that you have to build some experience before you jump in.
Okay. So where did you join from campus?
IBM. So I had joined as a relationship manager in the IBM sales team in Delhi.
And this was like hardcore B2B sales.
This was hardcore B2B sales, yes. Selling everything right from a desktop laptop to the IBM software, data center services, etc. So yeah, the end-to-end spectrum with a set of accounts.
And then you switched into like an FMCG kind of a role. So why did you make that switch from B2B to a B2C kind of a thing?
So the truth is, see, I for first 2.5 years at IBM, and the role was going very well. I think I learned so much about work life, about sales, and really, you know, standing for your own self in the IBM space. But my fear there was that, you know, for lifelong, I'll remain an IT salesperson, because at that time, I was seeing people around me who were doing that same thing for last 10 years, 20 years. Obviously, they were handling, let's say, a different size of account or different size of business, but it was typically the sales profile. And I think I was kind of a little jittery to imagine myself doing the same thing for all my life. So it was more the fear of being stuck in doing the same thing that I moved out. The other reason why I joined J&J Medical was more to learn the FMCG style of work, which is more distribution, more feet on street and really being on the ground. And it was still early years. So I really wanted to go through the grind, knowing that, you know, 10 years later, I would not do that.
And what were you doing at J&J? Like, what was your role there?
So J&J was, this was a division called LifeScan. This is J&J Medical. And LifeScan had brought to India a range of blood glucose meters to test blood sugars at home. Before this, there were no products available like that in India. So it was early years. We were trying to establish the whole business with, you know, doctors recommending home testing of sugars, patient education, and setting up the distributor and chemist and merchandise. Patient education programs was a big part of it. So, yeah, it was a whole hog, and we used to cover the ground, like, you know, meet general practitioners, meet, you know, internal medicine doctors, meet endo specialists, and really, you know, talk them through that how together we could convince patients to be more, you know, careful about their sugar monitoring.
So this was like a proper grind, typical FMCG grind, like on the
FMCG grind, 6 days a week, 100 kilometers a day on the road, meeting the target used to be meet 10 doctors, 20 chemists, something like that. There were Sundays which were dedicated to patient education programs, 2 or 3 days travel outside Delhi. So it was total grind.
Yeah. Did you enjoy it though?
Now I feel I enjoyed it. That time it was real hard work. No, so the good part about travel is you, again, the same thing. You spend so much time waiting for people or on the road. You talk to your team. You build, again, good relationships. I think you see real India. So I was covering Delhi, Rajasthan, Punjab. I also covered Jammu. Mm-hmm. So you get to see a lot of real India on the road. I think a lot of your life experiences are built with that kind of work you do.
And your family was okay with like this kind of a role with so much traveling and all?
I don't think they had a choice.
Okay, because typically Marwari families are very conservative when it comes to the daughter.
Very conservative. And people used to ask me, "Tumi IIM mein jaane ke baad sales ka kaam kyun karti ho? Why can't you do like something better, something in office?" They used to think that only, you know, the less smart people go out on the field. So yeah, it was not easy, but I think they did not have a choice.
And then why did you move on? And that also to like a completely different sector again.
So that was because my husband had got a great role in Bangalore. He was moving to Bangalore and I moved along with him. I said, I'll go figure out what to do in Bangalore. When we came to Bangalore, I think around that time, Bangalore was also buzzing with new startup ideas and all of that. So while I did interview with some of the bigger companies, I interviewed with Tutor Vista. It sounded very exciting. It was that time rated as the hottest startup around. So, you know, I took it up thinking more as a challenge that I've done MNCs for about 4.5 years. Why don't I dig my heels in and, you know, try something that is the next step to maybe starting on my own. So, yeah, I think part of the thinking was that.
And Tutor Vista was like a live classes, or online live classes kind of a product.
Yes. So Tutor Vista was like a K-12 homework help from India. So Indian teachers teaching students in the US online. So it was used to be like a chat, whiteboard, Skype kind of session.
And what was your role here?
I did multiple roles here. So I started with trying to do B2B sales for the US. Then I moved on to doing the tutor recruitment part, which I think was one of the most interesting things I've done in my career. Sitting in Bangalore with like a very small team, very low cost, we were recruiting, you know, like hundreds of teachers every month. Sign up women, the kind of work you are doing. Sign up women who are willing to do part-time work online. And most of these were early morning sessions or late night because these were mostly US timings. So we were convincing them that, you know, you could really earn an extra income by doing a few hours of work. And it's online, so you don't need to come out of the house. It was targeted to married women, women who were doing either caregiving or, you know, raising children. But it was interesting. We hired in an year, I think the maximum that we had hired was almost 1,000 plus teachers.
Wow. And you had some sort of a like a training process for them to train them on how to teach and the subject knowledge, or you looked at subject knowledge as a prerequisite?
So part of the subject knowledge is prerequisite depending on the qualification and the test that they used to take up. After that, there was some training, and then on the job, you would monitor, you know, how they're able to cope up with students in the US, especially communication. I think a larger issue we faced, and most of the students are looking for math help. So while you could find a lot of people who are good at math, the harder part is the communication. The student won't understand what teacher's been saying, which is what we used to check for. We introduced a grammar test because the biggest hurdle we faced was in written English, people were making massive grammar mistakes, and that we were not comfortable with. So for math teachers, I used to take a grammar test. Typing test. So other test was that, you know, and this is 12 years back, most people were so slow in typing that you will kill the whole interest, right? Like, something very slow. So we introduced a typing test. People below, I think, some number of characters per minute or below were rejected purely because they would be too slow on a session.
So how is Tutor Vista doing now? I imagine that time this must have been pretty high margin business.
It was high margin business, but the tough part was the cost of marketing was very high because we were marketing for the US. So I think, it was good from a unit margin point of view, but the cost of marketing, if you include, then it did have a challenge.
And then after like a fairly longest stint, you kind of bit the entrepreneurial bug. So like what happened then?
So the good news was Tutor Vista was acquired by Pearson. There was some monetization. We got some money. I was also having a child at that time, so this is 2010-11, I came out of Tutor Vista. I thought it's a good time to take a break. So I started working on an idea, which was art for every day. We called it AF Day. And it was more built around the Etsy in the US, where you could have, let's say, handmade, handcrafted products online. I think the big mistake I made was it was way ahead of its time. 2011, people were just getting started with buying books online. So buying handicraft online was like a long shot. So the numbers remained small, and whatever we attempted, see, as an individual, I think I learned massively about setting up a company, about setting up, you know, website, products, merchandising, selling, shipments. So e-commerce, we did the whole hog about the e-commerce bit. But the hard part was numbers were so small, and my calling was that, you know, if it's such a small business, I can't keep spending years and years running a very small business in the hope that market would grow at some point of time.
So how did you fund it? Like all of this would have costed, you know, how big was your team like when you set it up?
We were, I think, 3-4 people, mostly bootstrapped. I and my husband had put in some money. So we did it for about, I think, 14-15 months. And by then we realized that, you know, it's going to remain small. I think at the best month we would have done like, you know, a couple of lakhs of sale. So we realized that, you know, it will not survive without external funding. External funding would need, you know, people to see numbers moving. So it was chicken and egg. And we decided that it's not worth spending more time on it. We closed it.
And how did you meet your husband?
Arranged marriage. Completely arranged.
Okay. Okay, but he was pretty supportive of investing in your venture and...
Yeah. He's an investor for life. So he's been working at private equity funds. So investment is in his blood.
So then you moved on to Bluestone. And Bluestone is what, like a jewelry e-commerce?
Yes, Bluestone's an online jewelry business. So one big learning out of, you know, bootstrapping a business and shutting it down... I think as an entrepreneur, you'll have to, you know, build clarity around what you're doing this for. Because once you start investing time and money, actually, at times, you it's almost like bad money over bad money. Every few months, you'll have to set up milestones and, you know, check back on that. Is it meeting your milestones? What should you do? And dispassionately also at one day take a call that, you know, if it needs to close, it needs to close. So, yeah, I think that's the hard part. I look back at it and think maybe I should have given it some more time. But I think if you look at the macro part of it, more time, few more months would not have helped it. It would need a few more years. Because after that, let's say a business like Jaipur, etc., you know, there are a couple of other people who have built that out. But it was much later than when we were trying to do it.
And you shut it down, like, did you try and find a buyer for it? Or you just, like, wound up operations and...
It was so small that, you know, trying to find a buyer for it would have been a futile exercise. The other thing that, you know, personally, I did not have the time because my kid was like small. We started actually AF Day and Riddhi was born around the same time. So I think it was also a timing issue that I was not able to really move out physically. You needed to be around. So we were working from home. So it all added up.
So Bluestone was a fairly short stint. And you know, what was it that you did there?
So Bluestone, the role was head of sales. It was primarily building an offline sales channel for an online jewelry company. So a couple of things that we did were set up a team for home try-on. So let's say online people come visit, you can collect their numbers, etc. They will query on your call center. And then you can offer that, hey, someone would visit you and show you more or help you choose what you need or customize. So this was a more offline sales support team that we created. It actually had off the charts numbers in terms of conversion and AOV, etc. So it was doing very well as a program. Then we set up a few guide stores. So what you see today as a Bluestone or Carrot Lane store, it was different from that because these were built with like dummy sample pieces and not true jewelry like the gold or diamond pieces, but it was more to give people an idea that how a design would look like in real. They could try it on and then order for what they need and it would be delivered to them. So these were like smaller walk-in by appointment kind of centers where people could come and talk to someone who understands the catalog, who can help them browse, help them choose what they need to do, assist them in sales. So these were a couple of things that we were building around that time. The idea was, you know, online is great for people to discover that an option like this exists. They can browse through a lot of pictures and catalog and decide, you know, what shape, size, amount works for them, and then come and make a final decision. So the problem was that 100% online process versus creating an assist model looked like it was way better converting.
Right, right. Okay. So online for lead generation and then offline to convert.
Yeah. So even today, if you see both the two big online jewelry guys, both Bluestone and Carrot Lane, now have stores on high street and malls, etc. Because you need brand building, you need people to walk in, you need them to experience the jewelry, try it on, maybe show it to family. And then jewelry purchase in India is a very, like a family decision.
Right, right. So, and then you joined Ola from after a short stint here. So why did you make the move?
The true part is, see, one, I think I had done a startup of my own. I was working here and I think there was, an alignment issue between me and Gaurav, and I realized that instead of putting in more time where we are not aligned fully, it's better that I move on to doing something that I will put my full energy on. So that's why a shorter stint, and then moved on to Ola. Ola also, I was running the sales piece, and if you remember, originally, the whole point-to-point and on-demand taxi was not, you know, what was the biggest thing. So when I had joined, Ola used to also have a lot of pre-booked airport rides or pre-booked corporate business. While the point-to-point taxi was available, but, you know, it was expensive and very few people wanted to take it up. It was a growing business. So corporate looked like, and before Ola or Uber were in India, there was herds and cars on rent, or the cab rental business in the corporate was a very big business and a profitable business. So there was an intent to build the corporate side of business, is, and this I'm talking like, you know, 7 years back.
Okay. So you were again doing B2B sales here.
I was again doing B2B sales here.
Okay. And this is where... you kind of conceived of Fresh Menu. So what was that journey?
Yeah, so I think I was seeing startups all around me, and it was a buzzing time. I think at that time, the smartphone penetration was just picking up. A lot of apps, people were trying to build apps, people trying to figure out, you know, how do we get consumers to tap on a button and create services. And obviously, Uber is a huge inspiration for all the app startups, right? World over also food, there was a lot happening, and that's where the whole idea came about that, you know, we should also think of doing something in food, and delivery food is looking like the way to go.
And so, you know, how did this idea actually become reality? Like, did you quit your job first and work on it, or, you know, like, tell me about that journey.
Yeah, almost. I think once in Ola, I realized that, you know, I think... I had reached a point where I really wanted to go back and build a business where I really own the whole piece instead of working at a startup. So I think I kind of understood that at my journey is now to go back and create a startup. So once that decision's done, I think I moved out. Then next few months, we thrashed out the whole idea. I think food, doing something in food was decided when I moved out of Ola. But what to do in food and how it would shape up, etc., took a few months of planning after that.
Okay. So when you say we, what does that mean?
Okay. We means for this idea, I think my husband played a big role in thrashing out the idea. Also, I went to Ganesh and Srini, and they supported through the initial capital that is needed to seed the idea and to do proof of concept.
So what did you launch it as? Like, you know, what was the initial launch like? So you thought that, at that time, the word cloud kitchen, of course, didn't exist. So like, what did you think you're building? Like, did you think that you're building a restaurant which only does delivery, or like?
So Akshay, the idea around that time, and there were a couple of big pillars around, you know, how we thought of what would Fresh Menu do. And if you see, the choice of name is a very neutral name. It is not a cuisine name, it is not a meal type, it's not like a pizza, burger or biryani brand. It's a Fresh Menu.
Right.
So the idea was that we're building something for very long term. It has to be flexible because we did not have a hero product at that time. See, if you take license from a global chain, you know what is a hero product and what do you have to do for it. But here we had to create something from scratch. So one, the name was a neutral name. It was built on the peg of fresh, which means that, you know, something that people will believe is good for them. And for decades, it would be good, right? It will not go out of fashion. It's not something that is like a fad and it will go away in a couple of years. So a lot of thought went into the name. A lot of thought went into the business model decisions. Like, we will start with global cuisine. We will start with like premium pricing. We are not doing the daily dal roti dabba. We're actually doing break the monotony food because we wanted people to come back frequently. And everybody around that time who was trying to do a food startup actually started doing the dal roti kind of business, assuming that's the highest frequency player. And what has proved out is that, you know, no consumer will consume from the same company for 20 days in a month. The highest that you can get from a consumer is like 5 to 7 times a month. And that's more like, you know, what allows me to indulge a bit or what allows me to break the monotony. So I think we were on the right track with that decision. The business model was built on better unit economics. We understood the costs better. We took lower cost kitchens. We set them up behind the scenes because it was going to be delivery. And focus on mobile. So we never took phone orders because the temptation could be while the app is being built or, you know, people, how would you convince people to come online? Let's take phone orders. We never took phone orders. So I think some of these decisions worked really well for us. What we brought on to consumers was something they had never imagined, like a high-end restaurant, five-star kind of quality food and the kind of international menu, a menu that was changing daily, was brought onto their table and it was super cool.
Okay. And so like day one itself, you launched with an online ordering platform and customers had to like install an app to place an order?
Day one was a website. The website was built on Shopify.
Okay. And how did you set up the backend? I mean, you have no experience of running a restaurant, so to say. So, like, you know, what was setting up the first kitchen like?
The setting up of first kitchen, that's a very interesting story. So, the first hire is more interesting. So, I started looking for chefs and I contacted quite a few chefs on LinkedIn. And finally, the ones that I got to meet, they said, your idea sounds interesting, but if you are really successful, then I'll come and join you. And I said, yeah, so I need a chef to become successful. So it took a couple of months in just figuring out, you know, how to hire the first chef or, you know, how do you think about the menu? How would you do research? So while research, a lot of it I could do online, etc. But it really needed someone to come along and really do the back end. You're right. I think it was tough. So the story goes that I posted on like, I think Quikr or OLX, that I'm looking for a chef. And somebody called me that, hey, I'm out of job and I want to look at the role that you're offering. So I called and this person came in. We did trials at my home. And, you know, whatever he used to, so I asked him, how much do you, what's your salary? And he said, let's say X. So I immediately made it 30% higher and said, okay, you can start working with me today. So, yeah, I think you do some of the stuff is very, very interesting of how do you start a business. So while the idea is there, but it took and after that, this guy said that, madam, ek kitchen banane ke liye to kam se kam 3 mahina lagta hai. I said, no, our kitchen will be ready in 10 days. So we obviously put a makeshift kitchen together in 10 days and start rolling.
How did you do the initial customer acquisition? Like, how did people hear that, okay, I can order food from Fresh Menu?
Again, so multiple things happened while we were doing, while the kitchen was getting set up or the site was getting set up. We used to just cook food every day, deliver it to some friend's office, get people to try for free, and then check with them, okay, what are you liking? What are you not liking? How much would you pay for it? So obviously, we would really understand, you know, are they really even going to pay for it or not? So a lot of iteration went through that. So I think a lot of office sampling is something that got us successful. I've personally delivered to a lot of people's homes, offices for their parties, just try out our food. And that I think really helped us get off the ground more quickly. So corporate kiosk sampling, serving, you know, whoever was interested, really go to them, show them what we are doing. Invested a lot of time and effort initially on packaging and designing the food that it had to look great on a photograph. it had to be presented in a very colorful manner. It has to be very appealing in a box. And I think that's something that I think we were very, very product focused. That helped us a lot.
That kind of got the word of mouth rolling. And
yeah. And then I think for food, see, newspaper inserts did well. Once we were 4-5 kitchens, we started doing some radio, and radio helped us a lot because radio was building top of mind, you know, frequency recall. And morning, evening, if the radio plays and talks about a new food choice, a lot of people were coming to try it out. Then I think the standard coupons, etc., distributed with the flyers, with the newspaper, I think that's how we initially got customers.
And so 2014... you started this. So what did you end that year at, like 14, 15? Like, what kind of revenue did you hit? And I'm assuming it must have been one kitchen only at that time.
No. So we started, I think, in October of 2014. By March of 2015, we were probably six kitchens, if I'm not wrong.
Oh, wow.
I think we ended the year with, like, what? 3 crores of revenue? We ramped up revenue pretty quickly.
That's amazingly fast, like from 1 to 5 kitchens in a matter of months.
So 3
like,
crores became, I think, 30 crores next year. 30 became 72 crores year after. And then it became, I think, 120 crores, if I'm not wrong. So I think we ramped up very, very quickly.
So how did you manage this kind of explosive growth? Like, you managed to hire one chef to get your first kitchen up from 1 to 5. Like, you know, how did you manage that?
So actually, that's a long story. I think it's very hard to recall, you know, what all we did to kind of, you know, one, get the kitchen set up, get the staffing done, get the training done. Menu innovation on the side, the whole delivery piece. And trust me, 6 years back, there was hardly any trained delivery boys for food. So we were doing everything end to end, sourcing the material, costing of the food, photographs, marketing. I think if I look back, I think there were 1,000 things that we took on our plate. I think I was working 20 hours a day for those 3 years.
Wow.
But in a business like this, it's an ops business. The engine has to go on 365 days. Nothing can break down. Nothing can stop. So we were building tech for it. We were recruiting team left, right, and center. I think, it's a very thrilling experience to really go through that, get customer success. People loved what we offered them. The kind of innovation we were doing was, you know, I think nobody in the market had imagined that there would be a brand that would come and change menu almost daily, would churn out, like, you know, 40 new products a month. I think we were working at a breakneck speed.
And didn't rely on delivery partners. It was like your own team of delivery boys that you built up.
Bilkul.
So, how did the expansion beyond Bangalore happen? Like, when did you start doing that? And how many cities are you in now?
So, beyond Bangalore happened after year one. Bombay and Delhi is what we chose to start with, the other two cities. The idea was to, one, prove out that, you know, what works in Bangalore would also prove in the other cities in India. And Bombay and Delhi are both way bigger cities than Bangalore is. So fundamentally, you should expect a lot more scale in those markets compared to Bangalore. While it turned out that Bangalore is a much bigger delivery market for next few years. But yeah, we entered the other two markets with the size expectation.
And what about the funding journey? So initially, you had that seed funding which you raised. And then after that, like, did you raise subsequent rounds? And
yeah, so we raised money with Lightspeed, 5 million Series A in 2015, I think, or December of 2014 itself. And we raised Series B in 2016, which was another 17 million. We've raised about 25 million so far. So 2 rounds of funding.
Okay. And so was the funding journey like a challenge to overcome, being a woman founder at a solo founders, you know, so did you find it hard to get investors on board, or were your numbers more than enough?
No, I think funding is always it's a process. And I think apart from, you know, your work, effort, numbers, or presentation, there are more elements to play. So I won't say funding was a cakewalk. I think funding's been a tough process. For women, I think naturally, women tend to underplay what they are good at, what they're capable of. Their plans are not the most aggressively projected plans. And I think that comes in my way too. I learned the hard way to let go of my perfectionism streak because, you know, I think part of my experience with startups has been that you have to scale fast, you have to execute fast. And if you wait for the perfect thing to happen in a business like this, you know, perfection's very hard to achieve. And I could have waited for 2 more years to have a perfect product to roll out in the market. By then, the market would be gone. Somebody else would do it. So I think speed to market needs some sacrifice and perfection. You know, you should be convinced that iteration is the way to go forward. So I think there are learnings on the way, but funding for women, I think, is a tough nut.
Why is that? Like, what is the apprehension that...
So the part of it is our own apprehensions, our own projection, our own, you know, conditioning that, you know, others should notice what we are good at and we will not blow our trumpet like, you know, this is what I'm good at and this is why you should give me money. We're not the strongest on networking and really doing, networking for the sake of it. And I think I was too busy. Just this business needed a lot of time to do the groundwork, and it didn't leave a lot of time to do the other stuff that founders should be doing. So I think that's a lesson that, you know, a founder will have to really balance out what needs to be done for the company inside and what needs to be done from an external management perspective.
And how did your headcount grow? Like, you know, in 2015, what headcount were you at, and subsequent years, how did that grow?
2015, I think we would have grown from like, what, 100 people to 1,000 people in 1.5 years.
So by 16, you were like about 1,000 people, 16, yeah, 17.
I think at our peak, we would have been about 1,400 people.
And this was like what kind of people? Like how many of these were corporate? How many were in the kitchens? And
corporate was always about max of 100 people, probably below that. It was mostly people in the kitchens or supporting the kitchen, supervising the kitchens, delivery staff, a lot of delivery network. So it was a combination.
Okay. Do you still do delivery yourself, or are you, because now there are many startups who offer delivery as a service. So
we still do some of our own. So there is some dedicated delivery available. We also use third party like Dunzo or Delivery to do part of our deliveries. And Swiggy and Zomato would do their own delivery. So yeah, now it's quite a combination.
So is it still the same in terms of a menu which changes very frequently? Because now that your menu would also be listed on Swiggy and Zomato. So, you know, like how has the business evolved and what is it today now?
So I think over the years, we learned that this whole piece about daily changing menu, we should treat it differently. So, you know, customers don't need a daily different menu. They basically need new things from time to time. So what we did was now it does not change daily. But, you know, every month there are still about 40 new SKUs that get tried on the platform. Over the years, we've also figured out what works really well for us, what combinations people seek, what price points are working very well. So I think there's a lot of intelligence around the menu, flavors, photographs, portion sizes, offers. I think there's lots of inherent learning that we have collected over the time. And now we do new dishes with the guardrails around, you know, what would work in our system? What should we offer to customers? So I think today it is not a daily changing menu, but it keeps getting new stuff all the time and stuff that, you know, has become a little jaded or, you know, we see that numbers are below average. We would take it out of the menu, maybe a couple of months later, refurb it, change a bit of flavor, and then bring it back.
So what are some of the interesting trends you observed about Indian food habits? You know, things which might have surprised you that you discovered based on the data that you generate on orders and all?
So some interesting tidbits. See, Indians always eat food for taste. And while whatever else we say, I think taste remains paramount. Actually, till pre-COVID. Right now, I think the change that we've noticed is people are very, very particular about the trust and assurance of safety over taste. So COVID has pushed customers to be really, really focused on hygiene, safety, etc. around the food or anything from outside for that matter. And I think that's a big shift. It's a paradigm shift, because food otherwise has been an unorganized business where the right. organized players invest, you know, money and effort to be, you know, focused on food quality and safety and a lot of work behind the scenes, while, you know, the small restaurant operator or a small shop could get away with, you know, doing things in not the most scientific way. So I think that that's a big change. Some of the interesting stuff is, like, you know, when we introduced Thai on our menu, and Thai was very hot in India a few years back, right. you know, everybody used to say, hey, I love Thai on your menu. And I said, my sales are not supporting it. So basically, everybody used to talk about eating Thai food, but they were eating it like once in 4 months or 6 months. So, so some of the stuff is, you know, good to talk about, but not the best to eat regularly. The other thing we did, for example, something that has done very well for us is taking, you know, Mexican food to masses, taking teriyaki to masses. I think we've been running a teriyaki chicken rice bowl for the last 5 years now. And I think we are very, very, you know, well known for it. And I think somebody coined it for me that you've taken teriyaki to masses. And I was like, yeah, that sounds very cool. So okay. chicken and rice, so, I think, is a big staple. I think India loves chicken and rice in any form. So that we continue to offer in different avatars, and that keeps doing well. Desserts, I think indulgences is another big piece that, you know, while we'll all say, nahi, main meetha nahi khana chahta hun, but... I think we all eat sweets.
So healthy eating is for ghar ka khana, basically. When you order, then you want tasty stuff.
Healthy eating is also another trend that we picked up around 2017. We realized that health is not just a buzzword, but people are moving more and more towards, you know, more calorie counted food, healthier looking food, more greens, low carb, high protein. Keto was coming around the corner. The interesting part for us is people always thought that we're healthy food because we showed a lot of green, we showed a lot of veggies, we did a lot of grilled meats. I think inherently it was more healthy food than your restaurant food. And people believe that, you know, we serve healthy food in general. So it helped us. Then in 2017, we put a collection called Fit and Fab. And since then, it has only been growing in sales as percentage of our total sales. So healthy food is a reality. I think it is still much smaller than what we would want it to be. But every year it has been growing.
Okay. Is butter chicken the number one selling item?
on our menu, teriyaki and chicken tikka and I think burrito, Mexican burrito are the highest selling products.
Okay.
And the other one that you would not like to believe is like a chocolate cake.
Okay. So do you have like a different menu for different regions? Like would Delhi and Bangalore menu be different?
Slightly. So there are some local variations. Some of these are material constraints. Some of these are capability constraints or demand constraints, right? Like people in Delhi, let's say, prefer food a certain way or portion sizes a certain way. So there is local customization for local customization even at a hyper-local area.
Okay. So like one outlet in Delhi, like one area in Delhi could have like a slightly different menu.
Yes.
And how does Zomato deal with that? Does Zomato serve up a different menu or it shows some items as not available to somebody from that area?
So Akshay, we have done a lot of work in building a deep API integration. And I think that allows us to, you know, push a differential menu by location, by restaurant ID, you know, at times we've figured out that you could do differential pricing by the city, depending on, you know, if your costs are higher or something, if you've changed the portion size, etc. So I think that capability is built into the
system. You started about the same time as Zomato only, right?
No, at the same time as Swiggy. Zomato has been around for much longer.
So do you have any regrets that you got more into a like a actual nuts and bolts business where you're building the product and serving it up as opposed to the platforms which are more of a software play?
I think a tough question. I don't think I regret what I chose to do. See, aggregation is a very, very different business to do. What it showed around, 6 years back when we were really working through the ideas, aggregation was a capital play. Whoever would raise maximum capital is the one who would win. And in India, if you remember, there were a lot of people who started with aggregation. And there's only Swiggy and Zomato which are there today. So I think that was also a very tough play, and you could be wiped out very, very soon, because the match showed that you would lose money for years together. So I don't regret choosing doing a brand, because see, the real opportunity in India was that we are short of brands. We don't have national food brands. We don't have listed food brands. And customers are seeking new choices. The food palette was expanding. There was a lot of opportunity to be done in the space. So opportunity-wise, it looked very, very exciting. Yes, it's a tougher part. Like it's a more execution. Like you cook the food, you deliver the food, you build the menu. So yeah, it on paper, this would look like the tougher thing to do. But in India, you get rewarded for execution, right?
So do you see yourself as like the Indian Domino's in a way, in that sense, like delivering food, pan-India, quick and tasty food?
So see, as a business model, it is different from Domino's. Domino's is a global food brand. Domino's is a pizza company, and they have deep, deep expertise in pizza and delivery business. So yes, there is aspiration to, you know, do delivery as well as Domino's do, and the kind of reliability they've built around and the systems and processes they follow, the way they've attracted customers and kept customers loyal. So there are a lot of things to learn from Domino's and, you know, aspire to be like them. And there's clearly aspiration to be a market leading brand in India. So yeah, there is aspiration, but in a lot of ways, they're very different from Domino's. So we would not see ourselves as, just doing everything like Domino's is going to help us.
So over the years, what have you learned about building a team, you know, in terms of hiring and upskilling people? And, you know, what are some of the lessons that you've learned over there?
I've learned, I think, the most lessons in hiring, and you come from a recruitment business, so I'm sure you'll appreciate. I think when you're hiring for startups at growth stage, the kind of speed and the quantum of hiring that you're doing, I think one lesson is that you should be prepared to hire fast, and if things don't work, let go. While it does not sound the best way, but for the business, this probably is the speediest solution. So that is one of my lessons. As a founder, you have to be totally invested in recruitment. You have to spend a lot of time in recruitment. While you may believe that you don't have time to do recruitment, but without recruitment, things don't go ahead. And it's a full sales process. Like, and especially till you're small or till you're unknown, you have to do a real hard sales pitch to recruit your first few employees, right? Like, why should someone join a company which nobody has heard of? They don't even know, will you survive 6 months, 12 months? Will you be able to pay, not pay? What quality of work? Or, you know, I think it's a full sales process. So I think the good part was that I had done sales for long. So I think I'd also done recruitment. So I think recruitment and meeting the timelines, that whole rigmarole around the process. But yeah, I think there are a lot of lessons around how resourceful you could be around recruitment. You need to do a mix of, you know, self-hiring, use your LinkedIn, use your network, use agencies, be opportunistic about hiring. At times you have to pay more to do a quicker hiring. So I think that there are lots of nuts and bolts to recruitment. I think it may take a full another session to talk about the whole process. The thing that I have learned, the other pieces that after a year of hiring, you also need to get into a culture setting exercise and then have some filters of, you know, the next set of employees have to meet or be in a certain framework. Otherwise, it becomes very hard to manage the whole show. And I think we did go wrong in that piece in the middle. So that's a huge lesson that, you know, just for the sake of completing your hiring, while it works for some amount of time, it does not work forever. Culture setting is not a late exercise. It has to be an early exercise in the company. And you need to
really... How do you check for culture fitment?
Culture? Like, okay, for example, Akshay, for example, where I went wrong in recruitment is, depending on the past achievement of a person, you bring them on, and they've worked at a level different than where this startup is. Let's say somebody has worked at a much bigger company and they've delivered something as a growth there. But you are now where they were 6 years back. And you realize it while, you know, in the interview, they say, yes, yes, I would love the startup piece and I would love the excitement. But they're not willing to roll up their sleeves and work at the stage where we are. So I think that is partly where we went wrong. And that's something that, you know, we should do more check on of what's your stage, what would be exact, the kind of work that you would need to do, and are people ready to do that? The other is people, there's some people who don't scale up with the organization's growth. For example, the early employees feel left out when you start hiring a lot of other employees, or you start hiring a different level of profile, depending on the funding or depending on the size that you're aiming for. So I think there is also an expectation mismatch between old employees and new employees. And I think in a large people organization, it does get hard.
Like people earlier reporting to you would now report to somebody else who reports to you. So that would be a difficult thing for them to adjust to.
True.
Okay. So, you know, like you said, you're an operations heavy business, and which basically is like about having people who run those operations well. So do you have like a, you know, my first job was at McDonald's, and I joined when I was like 18 over there. I was doing this along with college just to earn pocket money. And I wanted to buy a two-wheeler to go to college instead of taking the bus every day. But their onboarding induction process was phenomenal. Like you literally, they would take an idiot off the street and train him to become a crew member at McDonald's. So do you have like that kind of an approach in your operations team, you know, how you hire and how you upskill them? Like, do you look for just some basics and then train them on the rest? Or, you know, how do you do that part of it?
So Akshay, I think that's a very good question. And this is something that these companies do very, very well, both Domino's, McDonald's, and especially with their global processes and then how they've optimized it for India. I think they're very good at this whole setup of taking an employee, getting them up to speed, following the process come what may. The SOPs are very, very strong. And as a So as a young company, I think it was not possible for us to have nailed everything. And we were doing things differently. It was not like an exact replica of a Domino's store or a McDonald's store. What we did was we obviously resourceful hiring, right? We hired a few of the Domino's and McDonald's or KFC store managers and brought in some of their practices into our system. And that's how part of the SOPs got developed. Then we went and spent time in having, for example, some experts and some consultants come in and really, you know, help us with the process mapping with, you know, what could go wrong, how to nail the problems, how to reduce your error rates. So I think you have to do the whole thing, but no company. And even today, I think we're 6 years old. And I think today also there's a lot that needs to be done better, that needs to be done more smartly. And I think it's a continuous process. But initially, I think the easy part is, you know, people who do it very well, you take off them and you learn from them. So I have no shame in saying that, you know, I kind of used what is a trained resource in the market and started with that.
Right. Yeah, I mean, that's the way to learn, like from best practices. So
by the way, now the thing is that anybody who wants to do a cloud kitchen business would want to hire from FreshMenu, because I think generally our training or our processes have worked much better. And we know that, you know, people get calls and say, just come and join us. They don't even want to interview.
So have you like made it idiot proof? Like you can literally hire anyone and make them a operations team member? Like, has it reached that level?
No. It will get there. I think it's still a few years away. But it is much, much less skill dependent than it was, let's say, even 2 years back.
So do you see the way ahead as more automation? You know, for example, I saw that Chaios now, they've stopped doing manual tea making and they've got a tea making machine there, which makes the tea based on whatever customization you select. And so that dispenses the exact amount of milk and water and all that. So is that the way you're seeing yourself going also? Like, you know, how do you see technology changing the food business?
Very interesting. I think, see, technology has changed a lot in the food business in the last 6 years. Though so far, I think the changes are more around the whole delivery piece or kitchen operations piece or the efficiency piece of it. I think the future holds that as volumes improve, you can actually get in more automated equipment. You can do some of the cooking processes that you do manually. You can get machines to do it, or you could get suppliers to do a part of your work and you do the final value add or finishing. See, I think the crux of this is you have to stand true to what you've offered a customer. For example, we've told customers that we're not adding preservatives to your food. We are not microwaving your food. It is not dumb food. This is the healthier, fresher, tastier food that you could get in 30 minutes, which means we have to do the last mile effort. We have to do the value addition for them. We have to bring them unique flavors. We have to bring them new combinations that others are not offering. So I think fundamentally, you'll have to stay true to why customers come to you. And after that, whatever you can do to ease your process, to dumb it down, to make it easier for the customer, to make it faster for the customer, to make it tastier for the customer, you will obviously do that. So it all does not happen in one day. The story of big data on food is still to play out because the data is still not big enough. You will, over the years, we have collected a lot of intelligence, and over coming few years, I think it'll keep getting more intelligent. And as volumes change, you will really plug and play better equipment, more automation, more forecasting to improve, food execution. But I think saying that it will be idiot-proof, it will be made by a machine and therefore it will become idiot-proof, I don't think that's the way we have adopted.
But largely you're saying that how technology would change would be better data, which would allow you to build better models and reduce wastage, decide what is the best way to do stuff. And, that's how you see, like data would power the tech transformation.
Saksha, there will be other things. So there could be, system level wastage management, there could be system level QC products, there could be more technology, more camera, more, algorithm in calculation of when should people expect a surge of orders, how fast they should prepare and work. All I'm trying to say is we are a food company. We believe that, people come to us because we offer them the best food possible in their local area. And therefore, that cannot be compromised.
Right. So how has COVID been for Fresh Menu?
COVID's been very, very tough. I think world over, food businesses have seen the maximum disruption in like a century, right? Nobody ever thought in food, even in a recession year, it'll go down like 5%, 10%. Food businesses don't shrink to like 20% of their size. And I think in India, with the severe lockdown that we had, food businesses had to like completely shut down. Delivery businesses were on, we were on, but it took us a while to adjust to, the lockdown and the changes that were needed, the new process, safety. Customers had become super scared. So for first 3 months, 4 months, there was nothing really moving for the business. And, you had to take care of people, you had to take care of suppliers, you had to think about safety, you had to think about really surviving in this year. And I think talking on like 22nd December, I'm very proud that we've survived the year. So
I think
surviving this year is like growing two times. So I think we've done well for the kind of hardships we had to face. Everybody chipped in. And I think this year has taught so much about resilience, about building mental capacity. We've done some bold things. We've changed a lot of processes internally. I think the downtime really helped a business like ours because we could do some of the reset that was waiting because, since we were running, we didn't want to touch and make wholesale changes. But right now, I think we've done wholesale changes.
What kind of wholesale changes? Like, give me some examples.
So wholesale changes, for example, in the way we would treat the manpower or staffing in a kitchen. And see, COVID pushed us to work with lesser people in kitchens, more distancing.
Okay.
So we've done, big menu iteration on, how the menu could still be delivered with lesser people. How could we offer the same quality and same speed with lesser people? So I think there've been some big changes on the menu. There've been some big changes on the cooking process, in the timing and the metrics process, and all this while maintaining safety and bringing safety to the top of mind for everyone in the system. So I think there've been some big changes.
Do you also have like service restaurants, or is it only kitchens?
we don't have service restaurants. We used to have one at the airport. It was done as a brand store, but that's closed now.
So that way you kind of got spared from the worst of it, because I think the worst hit are like the actual service restaurants.
Yep, yep.
Okay. So what kind of revenue are you currently at? Like last year, what did you close at, if you're at liberty to say?
It's still not public yet. So I would wait for that to go public. But right now, compared to pre-COVID times, we are at about somewhere between 60 to 70% of pre-COVID numbers. I expect post-March to get back to the full pre-COVID number. And post that, I think we're actually optimistic that we would do even better than before, purely because I think delivery foods, I think we've penetrated more homes. We used to be 70% office business. And today, if we are back at 70% of our old business without offices being open, without colleges and hostels being open, I think we have penetrated more homes. So I'm quite confident that, you know, as and when we get to normalcy, where, you know, schools and colleges could open, when people are getting back to work, when all these big offices and tech parks open, I think we probably would grow a lot more.
Okay. Do you also have like bulk deals, like providing meals to employees of a company instead of them having an in-house canteen, so that kind of stuff?
Yeah, so we've done that for more small-sized companies where, let's say, you have 30 to 50 employees because caterers don't serve that kind of requirement. And we also don't have to then customize anything. We use our single-serve meals and offer them choices, and they could change the choices regularly. So that's the kind of business we were looking at before COVID. Right now, we are talking to people to see that we could get into more packed meals as offices open. We've also been getting some inbound queries about people saying that now we will not have the buffet cafeteria. We can't allow people to, you know, sit and chit-chat in the cafeteria, which means packed food in office is a reality that is going to be served. And people like us are the best suited to serve that demand.
Right, right. So what is your personal journey like that you see in the next couple of years? You know, like what is it that you personally want to learn and discover which makes you more effective at work or whatever? But, you know, at a personal level, what is it that you are seeking?
It's a tough question, Akshay. Personal journey, see, I think we've last, and this year has been a very tough year to manage. I think personally, I would spend some time rewiring the way I would think or I would work, because I think last 6 years as an entrepreneur, as a CEO, I think it's taking a toll on your learning ability or openness to, you know, change. And I think I kind of recognize that. So that's something that I would spend time and effort doing on. Because I guess over the years, and you've got set in your ways, and I think right now I'm really thinking hard that, you know, how do I change, or how do I in some sense become unpredictable, because the predictable path's now done for quite a few years. So I think there's going to be some personal change, some resetting. I turned 40 last year. I think a part of it is also the age clock. So I think personal fitness has become a much bigger priority. So I think there's going to be change on the personal front, and I think self-learning, which kind of stops when you're too busy in your day-to-day work. So I think I'll pick up some of that again. From a business point of view, I think we're really roaring to figure out how do we become 10x from here. So I think that's going to keep us busy.
Okay. So what do you think will make you 10x?
See, I think
in how many years do you think that?
See, actually, honestly, in a business like this, we could become 10x in probably 3 to 5 years. And I'm saying that because we've spent the last 6 years nailing the business model. I think we've done so much work and effort in really optimizing on both, you know, the kind of menu that we could offer, the way we execute it, and the kitchen economics. I think today we are 100% sure that we can take it 10x from here. We could be in like the next 10, 15 cities in India and really scale out fresh menu, become a national brand, become a big brand, leading food brand in India. And I don't think I have a doubt about the economics and about the success potential that we have now. So we've gone through our tough years. We've had our learning. We have done the hard work about optimizing economics, about optimizing experience. And I think today we feel we're prepared. And dealing with COVID, I think there's more faith that we could deal with anything.
Hmm. Okay. Are you looking at a fresh fundraise? Or,
we're looking at a fresh fundraise right now. Yeah.
To power the growth to 10x, basically. To invest more in branding, I'm assuming.
Invest more in branding, invest more in opening the kitchens, opening more footprint, more cities, yeah.
And how is the investor appetite like? I mean, do you see investors being as optimistic about food tech and India both? Or like, you know, what do you see there?
I think early days, I see optimism come back because delivery food is here to stay is what I think a lot of people understand. Cloud kitchen is the best way to serve delivery demand is also understood now. So I think now it's about betting on businesses and brands that really understand, you know, that they could really follow this up. There are people who are already engaging, and I feel like there is cautious optimism about the business that we are in. So I feel like next few months we should be able to close around.
So you are also an angel investor. I think you've done a couple of investments. So what is your thesis as an angel investor? Like, do you have a thesis or is it just mostly like friends and family or kind of thing that
No thesis yet. Yeah. And it was just because, you know, there was something that I really liked and there's also people that I know well. So no thesis yet as an angel investor.
Okay. But is that something you enjoy? Like, do you want to do more of it? Or it's just occasionally if somebody needs a helping hand or as a way to give back or like what's the...
Yeah, I would remain a passive investor. I think I'm really thinking that next year I could help a couple of women entrepreneurs take their journey forward. I kind of understand that it is tougher for women. So I think a part of the priority would be to focus on women entrepreneurs.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. That's true. So, you know, one of our concerns at the show has always been to have a good gender mix. And we struggle just because there are so many more male founders than female founders. So, yeah, totally agree with you.
So that was Rashmi talking about her journey and learnings in the world of food tech. And if this episode has left you hungry, then do check out their yummy meals on freshmenu.com.
If you like the Founder Thesis podcast, then do check out our other shows on subjects like marketing, technology, career advice, books, and drama. Visit thepodium.in, that is thepodium.in, for a complete list of all our shows.